Previously on Beta.
When does it all end, huh? How many yachts can you water ski behind? How much is enough?
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
If it pleases the court, and even if it doesn't please the court, I'm God, Your Honor.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Philip Proctor and David Ossman of the surreal and subversive comedy troupe Firesign Theater on their record, Dope Humor of the 70s.
We captured our culture in a way that really nobody else did. And I think our legacy is the history of the 70s and 80s.
Also, the acclaimed British author Martin Amis tells us why he decided to write an autobiographical novel that also includes writing advice.
In writing, you make dozens of little decisions every page, but the big decisions are subconscious. They emerge with the force of instinct.
But first,
what if I could teach them how to sell to people with money, real money? So I decided to reinvent the company.
Gentlemen, welcome to Stratton Oakmont. You schnooks will now be targeting the wealthiest 1% of Americans. Talking about whales here. And with this script, which is now your new harpoon, I'm gonna teach each and every one of you to be Captain Ahab.
That's a clip from the Martin Scorsese movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. It's one of the films mentioned in the logline for Matteo Escarapore's debut novel, Black Buck. The book is described as The Wolf of Wall Street meets Sorry to Bother You meets Fight Club. Black Buck focuses on a young black man named Darren Vender. He quits his Starbucks job to join New York City's hottest tech startup, Someone. Darren is the only black person in the company, and after a grueling first week of training, he reinvents himself as Buck, a tough-as-nails salesman. We caught up with Matteo at his home in Brooklyn to talk about Black Buck and why he was inspired by The Wolf of Wall Street.
I would put it in the pantheon of classic sales movies, right? You have Wall Street, of course, with Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good. Anyone who knows sales and those types of movies knows that. Glengarry Glen Ross, Always Be Closing. The Pink Slips, Coffee's for Closers, Boiler Room. Even Death of a Salesman, right? The play. Those, in my mind, are the premier salesman. There's also a documentary called Salesman about Bible salesmen from like 1969 or back then. So taking stock of those films and the fact that I liked them, right? Even though what Black Buck is doing is in some ways redefining them or even tearing down what they symbolize, I liked those movies. So Wolf of Wall Street, there's a lot of pros and cons to it, but the energy that was in that movie, as well as how much sales was embedded in Jordan Belfort's identity. It was his identity. I wanted that to also translate into the book so that people who are familiar with those classic sales movies, plays, and books would be able to look at Black Buck and say, this deserves its space alongside these other movies, right? And it's also completely different, not just because he's a black man, but also because it takes place in the world of tech startups in this 21st century model of sales, which is so different compared to those other types. So I definitely did take some inspiration from Wolf of Wall Street, Fight Club, and literally dozens of other types of art.
A few years back, you had a pile of rejection letters, you didn't have an agent, and you've said that you were as close to creative rock bottom as you've ever been. How were you able to turn things around?
You know, I was misguided. That was one of my main goals, to gain representation and then become published rather than just writing a book that felt true. I got out of that hole with the help of reading On Writing by Stephen King. And it's funny, whenever I mention this, I also mention that it's cliche, just because a lot of people, I think, mention the fact that they wrote On Writing and it helped them in a way, but for good reason, right? Stephen King is a master of craft and a master of what he does. And when I read On Writing, a few things stood out to me. One was that he said, hey, I just write all of these books by getting my characters into scenarios and then figuring out how to get them out of it through hundreds of pages, or maybe not even getting them out of it. I said, huh, that's simple. Maybe I'm overcomplicating this. Secondly, he said, the best way to become a better writer is to write more and read more. I said, you know what? That's also simple enough. So I took those two pieces of advice while also understanding for him as a person that writing was just such a core tenet of his identity in the same way that I'm talking about Wolf of Wall Street and all those salespeople, right? How sales was a core part of their identity, that I had to integrate it as myself. I couldn't come to the page lightly, something also that he says. And I wasn't going to come to this career, this pursuit lightly and fumble around saying, I don't really feel like a writer yet. I'm never going to call myself a writer. I'll call myself a writer after my book comes out. I say, you know what? I'm going all in, more than before, and hopefully it pays off, because I know that beyond feeling as though I had at least an inkling of talent, I did believe that I had at least an inkling. I knew that whether I did or not, I was going to work extremely hard and that would serve me well.
Yeah, but I read also that while reading Stephen King's On Writing, you realized, and you kind of touched on it there, you realized that you'd been avoiding writing about the themes that were closest to your life, race, sales, and startups. Why do you think you were avoiding those themes?
Subconsciously, I don't think that I was ready to engage with them yet. I don't think that I knew who I was at that point in my life yet. I had known various iterations of myself in the past, especially when I was working at a startup, right? I knew who I was somewhat when I was in college. I knew who I was, again, somewhat when I was in high school. But at that inflection point in my life, after I'd left the world of sales and startups, which was such a core, again, a core, well, this is the theme, right? The core part of my identity. I had done some traveling. I still needed to better understand who I was at that point in time, irrespective of who I had been in the past and who I wanted to be in the future. And it was at that point that I have more clarity around myself, around my own experiences in the world of sales and startups, and around what it means to be Black in America at this point in my life. Because I remember what it felt like when I was younger. I remember what it felt like in college. I remember what it felt like, or the cognitive dissonance that I experienced while working at a startup. But I had to gain a better handle of what it meant at that point in my life. And it was just a confluence of multiple things, and also feeling the freedom that came out of that creative rock bottom of like, I'm going to write a book that feels true to me. I'm going to write a book that I believe will actually help people that have experienced some things that I've experienced, whether personally and professionally. And hopefully this will lead to an agent representation, but those are not my main priorities.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to tackle the world of sales?
The aim wasn't really to tackle the world of sales. It was more so to comment on a various manifestation of white supremacy and systemic racism. And for me, sales was just the tool that was most readily available to me due to my experience. If this were high school, I would have written about soccer because I was the soccer player and I had experienced racist things, you know, while playing soccer and where I was the only Black kid on this team. I don't think that I was intentionally trying to even condemn the world of sales or even vilify institutional racism, which I completely abhor, and it goes against, you know, every fiber of my being. But I more so wanted just to present a certain reality and certain things that transpire and let people make their own judgments. Because Doug, and again, I think you'll be with me on this, there are going to be some people, and there probably have been some people who read this book and say, I don't think Clyde did anything wrong. I actually agree with a lot of what Clyde said. I don't like affirmative action. I don't like discussions of racism, right? Even though, of course, 9/11, never forget, right? Holocaust, not never again, right? And of course, we need to remember all of these tragedies. But it does feel like when it comes to the Black experience, some people are like, yo, get over it, right? And this is just me paraphrasing other things that I've heard from people. So yeah, man, sales were just readily available. And I thought that it was also very fertile ground for a lot of insanity to take place.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about your experience in the world of startups and how you drew on that experience in writing Black Buck?
I'm happy you asked this. I was in the world of startups. I was extremely deep. I was extremely deep in the world of startups. It was my life. I was inseparable from the startup I was working at, and it felt like it was inseparable from me. You know, I gave all of my energy for, at times, 16, 17 hours a day, at times 12, you know, at the minimum, 10 a day. But for most of the time that I was in sales, I was at the top. I was a leader, a sales leader. I had dozens, if not more, people looking to me for advice, for help, for guidance. And while I definitely saw certain things. I was like, yeah, that's definitely not right regarding a variety of things. I didn't have people on their daily subjecting me to things that, that Darren was subjected to. But I have experienced the things Darren had experienced regarding race, regarding discrimination outside of the workplace in very extreme ways when I was younger. Things that people would be like, yo, you're making this up. So I translated a lot of that into the workplace because I know how it feels to be the only one. And I know that other people who are of a minority background, whether it's regarding race, gender expression, sexual orientation, religion, in the workplace can feel that these almost innocuous slights that are rooted in racism and discrimination are actually the size of the Grand Canyon. So I wanted the book to feel that way as well. And there's a certain hyperbole that doesn't feel hyperbolic for many of us that have experienced it.
Yeah, very well said. Do you consider Black Buck to be a satire?
It's hard, man. You know, when I started out writing Black Buck, I didn't consider it a satire. And then after, you know, my agent and I were pitching it, you know, people were calling it satire. And at first I pushed back. And then I better understood what satire is and how earnest and sincere satire can actually be and how it is the intersection of tragedy and humor, right? To be able to reveal reality. But yeah, I don't know. I hesitate to put Black Buck in a box just because I don't like to be boxed in. But I will say that it heavily features satirical elements, definitely. It also, you know, features elements of a tragedy. It features elements of a romance, of a comedy. It has all of this rolled into it, man. And it's just something that hopefully isn't easily placed into a box because what it is always shifting from one page to the other. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of reading it, I think, and the entertainment and enlightenment you get from reading it. Some readers might consider Black Buck to be a cautionary tale. Do you?
I do, yeah. It's definitely a cautionary tale in what happens when, I don't even want to say blindly, because Buck going into didn't like blindly submit. But what happens sometimes when you just follow white men, right? Like into the breach, you know, and just like, yo, like, if you don't know what you're doing, you could get got, you know, as we'd say. So that's a cautionary tale. Giving your whole self to something so quickly is a recipe for disaster sometimes, as is for Buck. Not respecting the, I don't want to say plea, but the opinions of people who love you unconditionally, red flag. When you start to do that, right? Like with your parents, your closest friends, red flag, and bad things will happen. I mean, it happened to me in a certain way. It's not even so much as a happening, but it's like I became someone who I wasn't proud of. And I had to work through that and work beyond it. And it's something that I'm still doing now every day.
Mm-hmm. So throughout the book, you include excerpts from a How to Sell book that your protagonist, Darren, has written. Why did you want to do that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole book was written by Darren. It's just so weird to say that. I did that because I wanted this book to function as a how-to as well, so that anyone who reads this book and pays close attention to it will be able to walk away with at least some proficiency in sales and what it means to sell, and understanding that sales is just a tentacle of the organism that is life, right? And it's not this random thing that's happening, but it is a part of the world that we live in, and it's very real, and it's a very real manifestation of it. And I also did it because I wanted to help people. And again, going back to my first point, I believe, and maybe this is too bold, but that if someone is reading this book, they pay very close attention and they look at these reader notes, they will be able to at least walk into an interview for an entry-level sales role, like a cold caller or like these sales development representatives in the book, and have a leg up in getting that and hopefully, right, in a place like New York or San Francisco, you're walking away or you're earning a $65,000, $70,000 salary so that you can better yourselves and your community, especially for Black and Brown people who read the book. So that was the intention. And when I was coming into the world of sales, Doug, I was given by one of the co-founders at the startup that I worked at, I was given these two sales books called The Little Red Book of Selling and The Sales Bible by a guy named Jeffrey Gitomer. And I loved those books. I loved them so much. I loved the way that Jeffrey wrote, and they just really resonated. So I said, this, I think, would be an interesting device that would keep people engaged and, you know, hopefully help them in some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's next for you? Do you have another book you're working on or thinking about?
Yeah, so I'm always working, Doug, and whether it's essays or other books and other ideas. And yeah, all I can say is that I am definitely working on something else. And yeah, I'm tempted, especially with people that I feel comfortable to just like divulge, but I'm learning that that's not always the best. So
yeah, understandable. ABC, like not only always be closing, in your case, we can say ABC stands for always be creating.
I like that. Yeah, we're going to coin that. Yes.
Absolutely. Mateo Escarapur, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time, Doug. I appreciate it.
Mateo Escarapur's debut novel is called Black Buck. Find out more about Mateo at WPR.org/beta.
We would have a script and then we could play with it and make it alive and change it as the characters, you know, informed us as to what was happening.
Philip Proctor and David Osman of the legendary comedy troupe Firesign Theater join us to talk about their first record in 35 years. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. This is a take one.
If you like subversive and surreal comedy, then chances are you're a fan of the Firesign Theater. The troupe made their debut on KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles in 1966. The Firesigns went on to create hilarious, groundbreaking albums that explored the creative possibilities multi-track recording offered. Now they've released their first record in 35 years, Dope Humor of the 70s. It's a two-record set that includes 83 minutes of freeform radio mirth, mayhem, and madness from the early 1970s. Surviving members David Osman and Philip Proctor met up with Beta Steve Gotcher to talk about the record, the troupe's legacy, and on being described as the Beatles of comedy.
They were a great inspiration, there's no doubt about it, and we even incorporated some material from the Beatles into our records as an homage.
Yeah.
One thing we had in common, we all met one another and got to know our work, we started working together, was we loved old-time radio. And we loved, you know, we created the long form comedy record, and the Beatles simultaneously released this incredible long form musical album. So it was a bit of synchronicity, and it was like, you know, a validation, if you will, of what it was we wanted to do with our comedy chops.
So Phil, here's a question I know you've never been asked before. If you guys are the Beatles of comedy, who would you say is the Kiss of comedy? They're also known as the Stupid Man's Devo.
Ah, okay. Well, us. I mean, we. You know, listen, I have a podcast of my own called Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show at sexyboomershow.com. And we just interviewed Casale, who was, you know, one of the founding members of Devo. And we found in the interview that we had an awful lot in common because he's an absurdist. And they started Devo as an art project. It wasn't meant to be a musical group. It was, you know, avant-garde. And I don't know any other comedy group that certainly, I mean, the comedy groups in general, four guys, a comedy group, are you kidding me? Who we're all shared an absurdist love of comedy based on the popularity of the Goon shows and kind of the crazy off-center humor of the English, who, you know, we're immersed in wordplay constantly. And that's one of the things that we also found we had in common. We love to play with words.
Well, and you guys were also prophetic. And I'm thinking especially of the way that you explored the implications of cable network narrowcasting and predicted GPS, like the GPS travel apps, like Ralph Spoil Sport Motors.
Shadow Valley condoms. If you lived here, you'd be home by now.
Antelope Hill, selected living, comfortable, easy, okay.
Antelope Freeway, this lane, exit only.
Yeah, I think I'll take the old Antelope. Less traffic.
Easy street.
Antelope Freeway, 1 mile.
Clean up Armenia. Get a hairlift.
Antelope Freeway, 1/2 mile.
Chili Avenue.
Let's see what they got in this car. Let's see. We got
Antelope Freeway, 1/8.
Were you consciously trying to predict the future?
I believe that we were consciously writing predictive material.
Yeah.
The best example of it right now is in our very first record, the second side was Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him, which was a predictive album about the downfall of the Soviet Union on one level. And on another level, we did a quiz show called Beat the Reaper, in which Phil Austin was injected with a mystery disease as the contestant and had to guess what it was in 30 seconds so that the topless nurse, Judy, could come out and give him an antidote.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's not correct. You didn't beat the Reaper. Doctor, bring the patient out and show the amphitheater audience and all the folks at home just what he's contracted.
According to my careful prosthesis, this man has the plague.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
You've got the plague. Well, isn't he a good sport, folks? We'll be back in just a moment with our next patient, but first...
And so he escapes the studio, and people are running up to him to touch him. Give it to me, touch me. They wanted to share his celebrity, and they wanted to share his disease. Now, does that sound familiar?
At heart, as writers, I think, at heart, although we loved mystery, we were really science fiction writers.
Right.
And, I agree.
And in that big genre, it holds everybody from, you know, futurists to fantasists to surrealists, really. That's where I'd put us as science fiction writers. Over the course of our entire career, we developed all kinds of worlds and characters and universes. And I mean, the Martian space party alone posits the idea of all of these space bubbles with entertainment going on in them and people traveling to outer space and having a great time. And the Martian space party, the president goes off to Mars with the giant lizard. You know, I mean, it was fantasy combined with science fiction, combined with a comment about what was going on at that moment. Nixon was going to China. That meant the president was going to Mars, because China was, as far as we were concerned in 1971, was Mars. Nobody had ever been there.
And I think the most other predictive thing that had an influence on everybody was, I think we're all bozos on this bus, which basically predicted the computer revolution.
Right.
And before that, Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, created the channel surfing. Click, click, click,
exactly.
Click, click.
Yes.
Come on up here if you want to eat. Come on up, darling. Don't be afraid.
Oh, that's weird.
I won't bite you.
Weird. Too much.
Is it too much? Look at this! Look at this steaming heap! Too much of admirable birds, correctly bound French fried chicken fingers, too many cuts of Mother Baker's deep dish sheep dip cherry stone pie, too many
really looks
cups
good.
Of slaw.
No, 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 man, I want more,
then
more!
Take some, friends, then dip deep, darlings, take some pot buttered throat clusters.
Okay, man, you've been talking a lot. Hand them over here.
Here you are!
Man, what? Oh, my God, they're still warm.
Say thank you,
they're
friends.
Covered with... thank you, this is amazing.
Say thank you.
Thank you.
With your mouth
Let's talk a little bit about the new record, Dope Humor of the 70s. It's a two-volume vinyl set?
It's a limited vinyl release. 500 vinyl albums are going to be out there. They can also get it as a download from Stand Up Records, and you get a PDF with that download, which is quite an elaborate book put together with pictures and everything, stories by Taylor Jessen, who is our archivist and who produced this particular piece of art for us. And it draws from like at least three different radio shows that we did in the 70s. Okay. We were so prolific at that time, and we so loved sitting around a big table together, making one another laugh, that it was a very joyous time for us and very unique. Who else had an opportunity to do that? Nobody.
One thing I wanted to say about the radio show, and this just came to me this morning, Phil, so I have brought this up before, but let me hit you with it. It's like what the Dope Humor of the 70s album is like pages from a sketchbook that essentially, there's a great drawing. Oh, that's a really funny picture. Oh, that catches the moment, from a giant volume of all of our pictures together, of all of our art that we did on radio.
Yeah. One of my favorite pieces that you included on this new record, which is also on Dear Friends, is the Chinchilla Show. And that I listened to it the other day, and I was cracking up as much as when I heard it the first time. Is that an improvisation, or was that written out?
I wrote it, and it was based on, I guess, either in a comic book, at the back of a comic book, it was Race Chinchillas for Fun and Profit or something, or it might have even been a television commercial, but inspired me to write this thing about mutant chinchillas. And I brought it in. We often did this. David would bring in original material for the four of us, or we'd write something for two of us, and then decide who's going to do it on the spot. So Phil Austin did it with me, and he improvised on the script, which is the way we always worked. We would have a script, and then we could play with it and make it live and change it as the characters, informed us as to what was happening.
I'm the chinchilla. The chinchilla was a squeaky pickle, right?
That's right.
Was it a squeaky cow? I think it was a cow.
Both.
Up and down.
We had one of those little cow cans.
Oh, yeah.
And when you shook it, it went.
That was this poor chinchilla who dies tragically.
Careful there. Is he getting away?
That's all right. We got a lot more of them, and they do that, and that's part of the fun of raising them. And they're very clean animals.
I wanted to ask about that.
They're very clean. And if they do mess, as we refer to it, they'll do it in their little cages, and it doesn't make any difference. And they dig a little hole for it also.
Is that what this one's doing here? Can we get a close-up of that?
No, this one's just trying to get away. That's his mate over there. That's the one they're trying to catch.
Well, look at that. They just caught it. That's... Our floor manager just told me they stepped on it.
That's a female.
Segwaying from radio into your studio productions, when you started doing long-form records, I mean, it was a bold idea to say, I'm going to do a comedy record, and I'm going to make the bit 38 minutes long. Did you have an audience in mind, or did you just want to do it that way and hope the audience would find you?
Oh, by the time we did the 38-minute album, which is Don't Crush That Dwarf, we knew we had an audience. And the desire to do both sides of the record. First album has three cuts and a second side. It's more like a comedy record or a rock record in that way. Second record has the longest LP ever released, 28 minutes on both sides, Nick Danger and How Can You Be in Two Places at Once? But they're two different sides, even though you get to one through the hole in the middle of the record. I think Nick Danger finds his way through. But it's the pizza guy who manages to get through the hole in the middle of the album. But then by the third album, we wanted to do a whole album. We wanted to do the whole record.
One whole story.
And so even though it was 38 minutes, it could have been 42 or anything we could have fit on. It just, that's what it turned out to be. and disc jockeys on the radio, people who loved us and wanted to play us, learned to needle drop on that album. And so they could just get out the breakfast scene. You know, they could just take out pieces of the album that they thought were really funny. Principal Poop, drop the needle and lift it. And so that's, we got a lot of play that way. Well, hey, the lifted before the bad words went out. But making the original, the Dear Friends album, which was the precursor to Dope Humor of the 70s, was to get us some more airplay.
And lo, there came unto them Philip called Punter. And he was Lillian Roth in his extremity. Merrily, merrily, he says unto them, saying, merrily, merrily, for I am come. And he came, unto the house of his mother's brother's servant, saying, where am I? And there was none there to answer him, not even no one, saying, nowhere, yea, but in the land of reversible cups and sanitary pedestals. And he lay in that land a long time, like worms out of a hot cheese log.
Because we started on listener-supported radio, our records were listener-supported records because they were to be, as David said, they were to be listened to in the privacy of your own mind, you know, and because we call them movies for the mind, too. And then if you liked it, you could tell your friends. And then if they liked it, they'd buy another of our records.
Yeah, and I was thinking about all the phrases, those phrases that people remember. And it's like a very well-written pop song with lots of hooks in it. And those phrases are like pop song hooks. And they're just all over the place. And they're in the background, they're in the foreground. There are some that you would expect would be there and others that people come up with that you wouldn't have expected they would have recalled. Did you guys set out to do it that way, or did it just happen that way?
Oh, we knew a hook when we heard it. You betcha. The minute Bill Austin said,
you know, I think we're all bozos on this bus. Oh.
We knew we had the record title, we had the promotion, everything was right there. No, definitely, we knew the effect of words. I mean, we were writers, so we knew what words could do. And because people took these records home and listened to them by themselves, stoned out of their gourds, you know, we knew it would have a deeper effect, let's say.
Psychedelic effect.
It's psychedelic effect.
We were rewiring their minds. We were deprogramming people. And, yeah. And you know, we were fearless in that regard. We were very Marx Brotherian in that regard, you know. And that was one of our intentions.
Right. I was listening to some records over this past week, and I was amazed at how well they stand up. They do not sound like a place in time. They sound as contemporary today as they did then, and that is amazing. And I'm wondering, is it because you were writing more about universal and philosophical issues just below the storyline instead of sketches reflecting contemporary pop culture?
Essentially, all the albums, especially the first quartet of albums, are about power. We were concerned with power, its uses of power. That's a constant that runs all the way through our work, right from Waiting for the Electrician to either plug us in or unplug us out. And the electrician came to us really from the European avant-garde via Peter, who had just gotten back from Berlin. He had he was conversant with, you know, with that world, the world of Waiting for Godot, let's say, which I think had an impact, for example, on us. When you think of two guys talking in the middle of nowhere under a tree about how they're waiting for something, that's, you could use that. That's good material. Thanks a lot, Sam. You know, and Peter came back with that title and said, we're going to write an album called Waiting for the Electrician or someone like him. So we said, okay, we'll do that. Whatever you say, Pete.
We don't have much time. There's a lot you have to know.
Now, listen carefully. If the revolution is to be successful,
it is. Wait, first thing,
revolutionary leadership.
No, codification. The codification is the central control.
What do you think is the legacy of Firesign Theater?
The legacy is that we influenced, or one could even say infected, many minds. I called it a bad head cult. And there are people out there who, you know, who carry on the legacy of the Fireside Theater in their language and their in their, you know, during their daily lives, because they like to gravitate to comedy rather than seriousness in order to kind of counteract the dark that's happening. We, in some of these interviews, we've mentioned several times, levity is the opposite of gravity. Okay. So I think it's like Ray Bradbury, who we both knew and loved and worked with, he wrote the novel Fahrenheit 451, in which people memorize books and were, you know, living books. That's kind of the way I think of the Fireside Theater, that the, our body of work has been absorbed into the culture, and people are influenced by it even today, and it's part of their lives.
In terms of legacy, we have a huge body of work. It really is enormous. I mean, that 80 hours of radio is just part of the radio. I must have 200 hours of Radio Free Oz that nobody's listened to for 40 years. I mean, we captured our culture in a way that really nobody else did. And I think our legacy is the history of the 70s and 80s.
Well, David Ossman and Philip Proctor, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Stephen, our pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Philip Proctor and David Ossman are the surviving members of the legendary comedy troupe, the Firesign Theater. Their latest album is called Dope Humor of the 70s. They talked with Beta Steve Gotcher. Find out more about Philip, David, and Firesign Theater at WPR.org/beta.
And I respect death. I'm glad it happens. I think it should happen. I think immortality is a repulsive idea.
That's veteran British author Martin Amis. He joins us to talk about his autobiographical novel, Inside Story. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Martin Amis is an acclaimed British author and literary icon. He's written 15 novels, 2 short story collections, and 8 works of nonfiction. It's safe to say he knows a thing or two about writing. Born to the famed novelist Kingsley Amis, Martin has spent his life surrounded by great writers, including Saul Bellow, Salman Rushdie, and even his former stepmom, Elizabeth Jane Howard. Now he has released an autobiographical novel called Inside Story that turns all of these influences into characters. The book has its roots in the death of Martin's best friend, the English intellectual and socio-political critic Christopher Hitchens. Amis also includes writing advice for budding authors and for those who just want to get Martin's take on the craft. We zoomed in with Martin at his home in Brooklyn to talk about writing, his friendship with Hitch, and why he structured this novel like a literary mixtape.
It just emerged. I wanted it to be digressive and even pedagogic. Why did you decide is usually the wrong verb, because in writing you make dozens of little decisions every page, but the big decisions are subconscious. They emerge with the force of instinct and not from the front of the brain, but from the back.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to write about yourself in the third person?
It comes as a big relief when you're writing about embarrassing things. It's a marvelous means of detaching yourself from what you actually did. It's weird in fiction when you have the third person narration, but then the minute you type in the word I, it's like a zoom shot in a film. You really do narrow in on just one sensibility, and it's liberating in a way, but also limiting as well. All I would have been monotonous, and all he would have been monotonous. So if you can find a way to vary them depending on the context, then I think it has to be a game.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, the subtitle of your book is How to Write. Why did you decide, I'm using the wrong word. Okay, but let's try it anyway. It's too late. Why did you decide to include writing advice?
Well, because I'm addressing a young reader. And I think that the urge to write is almost universal, as I sort of demonstrate in that anecdote about giving a talk at my middle daughter's school. And I asked the assembly how many of them had considered being a writer. They were all 15 or so, 15 years old. And more than two-thirds of the hands went up. And I think it is something that naturally coincides with adolescence. This desire you have to commune with yourself and to take notes and to write poems that comes upon us when we become articulate in this new sense when we're adolescent. So it does seem to me like a near universal human urge.
Your father is the British novelist Kingsley Amis. How much did having a father who was a well-known, successful writer play in your decision to become one?
I mean, I do think it's an extraordinary thing. If you want a father who's going to push you towards writing, then better to have a coal miner than a novelist. I mean, certainly numerically far more predominant. It's very rare to have two generations of writers. Not rare to have siblings who are writers, but two generations. I don't know why, but it's rare in any language, in any literature. So it does de-glamorize it, and nothing is more banal than what your father does for a living. When I was young, I think everyone makes the decision or forms the aspiration to be a writer in adolescence before having much reading experience. It's just an attractive sounding way of earning your living while having an adventurous inner life. But it did and succeeds to this day to de-glamorize the process. My impression is that in contrast to my writer friends, it doesn't strike me as such a big thing to be a writer. I think it sounds to me like a tremendous thing for someone who's born with school teachers or military people or whatever it might be, for a child to emerge from such a background and become a writer, as my father did, does seem to me an extraordinary thing. But it doesn't seem extraordinary to me to be the son of a writer and then go on to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I also had a stepmother for 18 years who was a very distinguished and brilliant novelist, Elizabeth Jane Howard. There were three novelists in the house for many years, and that is bound to have peculiar results.
Mm-hmm. After your father passed away in 1995, my fellow Canadian, the esteemed Saul Bellow, became kind of a father figure for you. What was your relationship with Saul Bellow like?
It wasn't father-son relationship. He was a mentor, certainly, but it was much more like a friendship with a tutor. It was very affectionate, and I'd spent time encouraging him. Very early on in our friendship, I wrote a long piece about him for a British newspaper. And when his agent read the piece out to him for 4,000 words over the phone, and I've never forgotten this, she said, when I'd finished, he said, "Read that again." And I thought, now this is a man who's already won the Nobel Prize for Literature, as well as being the most decorated American writer in history. And yet they still want reassurance. They still want praise from the right kind of praise, from the right kind of reader. And about halfway through the friendship, he began manifesting symptoms of Alzheimer's, which then did very much limit discourse we could have.
Mm-hmm. You consider Bellow to be the greatest American author ever. What makes him so great?
It's very hard to define, but it's something to do with the weight of his words. But it's to do with the question of authenticity. When he tells you something, it's not for effect, it's not for show, but he has none of that. It is all business, his prose.
Yeah. I think the most poignant portions of Inside Story deal with your great friendship with the late Christopher Hitchens, the British intellectual and critic. What was it about him and about you that made it such a great friendship?
Well, it started very young. We were in our early 20s. And it was just one of those meetings of mine with a fair bit of just homoerotic attraction. In that I think there is a in close passionate friendships between men, I think there is some unspoken homoerotic element that is just accounts for the force of the attraction. And there was that too. He was very charming and sort of winsome. You know, he would certainly tailor himself to be charming to you. And teasingly, intellectual teasing. I gave him some release from being a Trotskyist and very earnest about many things, that my triviality was a kind of vacation for him.
Your triviality, meaning that you didn't talk about such, you didn't bring up such weighty subjects?
Well, I was apolitical when I was young. Mm-hmm. I was just totally literary. But he said, he did say to me that it was nice not talking about politics all the time, talking about sex a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Christopher passed away in December 2011. Can you tell us about his last moments?
Well, I was there, but he was unconscious for that last stretch. But I'll tell you his last words. It's an odd subject, last words. And I look into it in this novel. But, you know, he was a Trotskyist, frequently arrested, rabble-rousing Trotskyist. And then when it came to it, at the very end, and I wasn't present for this, but his son was, and he told me about it, Alexander Hitchens, just came out with one word, which was capitalism. And Alexander sort of came closer and said, is there anything you want to add? And Christopher just added the word, downfall. I thought that was great. I mean, characterologically great.
Yeah. Yeah, it says a lot about him. Yeah. Do you have a favorite memory of Christopher?
Well, I do. And it's we were in a restaurant once, a tiny restaurant. And there were two upper-class fops, young men in the restaurant who were rearranging tables for some big party. And we sort of found our conversation interrupted by them. And then at one point, one of them came over and crouched down and pouted up at us and said, in a flirtatious way, he's about to ask us to move tables. And he said, you're going to hate me for this. And Griffin said, we hate you already. That was as final as anything I'd ever heard.
Yeah. That's great. That's right up there with his two last words. I'd be hard pressed to pick between the two as to which was better. You're 71 years old now. Your father died when he was 73. If you don't mind my asking, how heavily does mortality weigh on your mind these days?
Well, it's always there. Yeah, like a song that you can't get out of your head, an unwanted song. But I think it's sort of, it's fairly possible, reasonably achievable to get on decent terms with it. And I respect death. I'm glad it happens. I think it should happen. I think immortality is a repulsive idea. And Christopher was a great example to me because I thought he met it as stoically and without any diminution of his own personality. Dr. Johnson said, in the sick room, the process of equalization begins, that process that death completes. That all distinctions between people are bleached off as you head towards death. And you become bad-tempered and you're no longer funny or agreeable. That's what Dr. Johnson said, but Christopher disproved that, and he kept his own thisness, his quiddity, right to the end, and his manners and his thoughtfulness were still beautifully attuned, and no self-pity, no talk about not deserving this early death, none of that. Met it face to face, without any loss of charm.
Martin Amis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Amis is the author of Inside Story. You can get the Inside Story on Inside Story at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Matteo Ascarapur, Philip Proctor, David Ossman, and Martin Amis. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I came out of 12 years of college and I didn't even know how to sew.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
You may have seen me loitering around the drugstore drinking chocolate malted Vulcans and giving away free high school.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
You've got the wrong man. I spell my name, Danger.